Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading from The 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution, and continuing with campaign number 4, The Times That Try Men's Souls, The Crossing Across the Delaware, and 10 Crucial Days. Washington and his army crossed the Delaware into New Jersey and surprised the British and the Hessians on December 25, 1776. Afterwards, Lord Cornwallis and the British army left Princeton on its way to meet Washington at Trenton, evening of January 2, 1777. Washington and his aides discuss a plan to bypass Cornwallis's army and attack Princeton by using a backcountry road from Trenton to Princeton. Late that evening, on January 2, 1777, Washington called a council of war at the house of Alexander Douglas. The dangerous situation therein was evident to each of his officers. No one wanted to retreat from Trenton, but neither did they want to risk a tragic defeat at Trenton that could cripple the war effort. Considering that the British only had about 1,500 men at Princeton, the number he, Washington, had defeated at Trenton, and knowing about British defenses and the little-used road, Washington and his officers put together a plan to make an all-night march to Princeton by a route that kept them well away from the British troops at Trenton. They called in several local militiamen and interviewed each separately to compare their recommendations for a roundabout route avoiding the British army. The chosen route, for which the men were designated guides, followed a road used by the Quakers to travel between the Princeton and Crosswick meeting houses and join the little-used back road that would allow them to surprise the British army at Princeton. Following this route, Washington would avoid renewed battle with Lord General Cornwallis and instead take on an enemy force in Princeton that he significantly outnumbered. After defeating that Princeton force, he could then capture supplies the British left at New Brunswick and then march his troops to Morristown in northern New Jersey. There, they could take up defensible positions in the Watchung Mountains, monitor the British in New York, and be on the flank for any British forces attempting to cross New Jersey during that winter or spring. The Council of War that night broke up, and the officers returned to camp and quietly gave the orders to break camp and form up to march. Some militiamen were assigned to stay behind and keep the fires burning all night. The American troops were not completely successful in concealing their departure from the opposing British sentries. But when informed of perceived American movements, Lord General Cornwallis, the British commander, discounted any danger. Cornwallis simply thought the troops were moving to defend the fords up the Assapink Creek, or were preparing to cross those fords and surprise the British on their flank in the morning. Cornwallis's only response was to reinforce his troops at those crossings. The American army departed so secretly that even some Americans did not get the word. Among these was Dr. Benjamin Rush and several of his assistants, who were attending to wounded men in a house that he had converted into a makeshift hospital in Trenton. In the middle of the night, they discovered that the army had departed for parts unknown and hurriedly got their patients into wagons and took them to Bordentown, thinking Washington had gone there. Overnight, the temperature dropped into the 20s and refroze the muddy roads, turning them into a rough, slippery, concrete-like surface. After traversing the icy roads all night, the leading American units arrived around daybreak at the junction of the Quaker Road and the Sawmill Road. Here, Washington split his army into three divisions. General Mifflin would continue along the Quaker Road towards the main highway. An advance group of about 500 men under Colonel Nicholas Hausiger would move out first to cross the main road and proceed on farm lanes to the northwest side of Princeton, ready to help to take the town and prevent the escape of British soldiers. Approximately 1,000 men under General Mifflin would wait and then follow as far as the main road, where a bridge at a large gristmill crossed Stony Brook. They would destroy that bridge to delay General Lord Cornwallis from getting back to Princeton until after the battle there had ended. Another large division with several thousand men under General Sullivan would follow the Sawmill Road to just behind Nassau Hill on the campus of today's Princeton University and attack the center of town. The 3rd Division, with about 1,800 men, led by General Hugh Mercer, would begin marching on the Sawmill Road, but then break off and approach the town from the center so that the troops there would be hit on 3 sides, much as the Hessians at Trenton had been on the 25th of December. While Washington formed up his troops, British Lieutenant Colonel Charles Mawhood led some 500 to 800 troops out of Princeton, heading down the main road towards Stony Brook Bridge and Worth's Mill to support General Cornwallis at Trenton. After crossing the bridge, the vanguard of light dragoons ascended a hill known locally as Cochran's Hill. About the time they reached the hilltop, the rising sun on that bright, crisp morning glinted off some shiny metal associated with the troops of Sullivan's division on the Sawmill Road about a mile away. A dragoon officer, distracted by the glint, saw the troops and reported to Colonel Mawhood. At about the same time, American troops likewise were distracted by a glint and saw the British dragoons on Cochran's Hill, thinking they were just a routine morning patrol sent out by the British from Princeton. To investigate the unknown troops heading towards Princeton, Mawhood of the British sent a dragoon officer down the hill to determine their identity and numbers. General Washington ordered General Mercer to detach his brigade of about 300 men to cut off the perceived British patrol and prevent it from notifying the troops in Princeton. Upon learning that he faced a considerable force of Americans, Colonel Mawhood of the British turned his column around and led his regiment, along with his mounted and dismounted dragoons and some of his transient troops, towards the Clark Farms to intercept the enemy troops that he now knew outnumbered him. Mercer of the American and Mawhood of the British troops met on William Clark's farm, and the battle ignited. After an exchange of volleys, a British bayonet charge forced Mercer's men, who generally lacked bayonets, to retreat. In the melee, Mercer's horse went down. Mercer fought on foot, refusing to surrender until surrounded and repeatedly stabbed in the abdomen. Cadwalader's brigade of about 1,500 men, who were mostly American volunteer militia known as the Philadelphia Associators and included a multiracial force of Pennsylvania Marines, entered the fray to support Mercer. Mercer's retreating brigade and the advancing British disrupted Cadwalader's American soldiers. However, the Americans stabilized things with the high-quality assistance of Captain Joseph Mulder's 2-gun Associator Artillery Company. As the melee developed, General Washington noted that the action was more significant than anticipated. He pulled out 2 brigades of Pennsylvania and Rhode Island Continentals and personally led them in a counterattack on the left British flank. General Washington rode between the two armies, exchanging fire, and miraculously escaped before being injured or killed, earning the deep respect of his men for his courage. About the same time, American General Mifflin sent some men from Quaker Road to engage the right British flank. Attacked on 3 sides by larger forces, the British had to retreat. It became a rout, and the Americans took many prisoners. Both the William and Thomas Clark farmhouses, along with others near the battlefield, became makeshift hospitals for the wounded of both sides. Thomas Clark's house received the mortally wounded General Mercer of the American Army, and he was cared there for until his death on January 12, 1777. The fighting continued as Washington's forces advanced on the town, and the 1 British regiment left there made a brief effort to stop them before being completely overwhelmed. Mop-up actions took place in and about the town, and more British became prisoners. The final action seems to have been at Nassau Hall, where a few British troops had taken refuge. After American artillery opened fire in the building and several cannonballs came through the windows, they surrendered. The British had lost some 450 killed and wounded, along with 200 to 300 taken prisoner. 30 to 40 Americans were killed and about the same number wounded. Just as British troops began arriving from Maidenhead and Trenton, American General Mifflin's men destroyed the Stony Brook Bridge. Washington withdrew from Princeton, but found that his men were so exhausted from the night marches and 2 days of battles that he could not ask them to march to New Brunswick. He decided instead to go directly to Morristown, New Jersey. When Cornwallis came back through Princeton, he headed straight to New Brunswick, fearing that Washington would take the supplies there. This decision allowed Washington to get to Morristown unmolested, although it took several days. After these 10 days of fighting, the British did not try to reoccupy Princeton or Trenton. Instead, they withdrew some units to New York while maintaining containments at New Brunswick and Perth Amboy. This pullback removed significant numbers of British soldiers from New Jersey. The state government reconvened while Washington rebuilt his army at Morristown, allowing the Patriots to feel protected while the Loyalists felt more exposed. In addition to the main camp at Morristown, Washington established military posts at Trenton and Princeton. For the rest of the winter and into the spring, American troops harassed British foraging parties sent out from New Brunswick and Perth Amboy. The resulting skirmishes, referred to as the Forage War, kept the British soldiers on a campaign footing, and the men suffered greatly. News of these 10 days of victory spread first by word of mouth, followed by letters and newspapers. After arriving home in Connecticut later in January, American Captain John Chester wrote, "You cannot conceive the joy and raptures the people were universally in as we passed by on the road. 'Tis good to be the messenger of glad tidings. They make an amazing alteration in the faces of men and things." A year later, American chaplain David Avery commented that news of Trenton and Princeton flew upon the wings of the wind and at once revived the hopes of the fearful, which had almost fled. How sudden the transition from darkness to light, from grief to joy. Supporters of American independence gained confidence in ultimate victory, interpreting the successes as proof of God's will, that America should be independent, and that Washington's seemingly miraculous victories were preordained. Looking back on the 10 crucial days, British officers acknowledged both Washington's leadership qualities and their own commander's mistakes. Captain Johann Ewald wrote that they had intended to resume battle at Trenton on the morning of January 3rd, but Washington spared us the trouble in his route up the back road to Princeton. Ewald credited Washington with realizing that General Cornwallis would seek to atone for his mistake in not using the Assunpink Fords to attack the American flank back on January 2nd. Therefore, Washington had broken camp, and, since he could not risk returning across the Delaware to Pennsylvania, he made such a forced march under cover of darkness that he arrived at daybreak at Princeton. General Cornwallis had thus contributed to Washington's reputation as an excellent general by simply and solely refusing to march his army in two columns from Princeton and outflank Washington at Trenton. Twice at Trenton and then at Princeton, the enemy was despised, and as usual, we had to pay for it. British Lord George Germain commented to the British Parliament in 1779 that things had looked very positive in December 1776, but all our hopes were blasted by that unhappy affair at Trenton. Not long after hearing of the climactic victory at Yorktown in 1781, the citizens of Annapolis published a letter to General Washington. It proclaimed that the successes at Trenton and Princeton laid the cornerstone of our freedom and independence, and that the capture of Lord General Cornwallis and his army has completed the edifice and secured the temple of liberty to us and our posterity. These 10 crucial days comprise one of the 10 crucial campaigns of the American Revolution, turning the tide of the revolution and allowing it to continue for another 6.5 years to a successful conclusion. This ends the essay on campaign number 4, The Times That Try Men's Souls, The Crossing Across the Delaware River, and the 10 Crucial Days. Campaign number 5, Gentleman John Burgoyne's Great Gamble, Ticonderoga to Saratoga. John Burgoyne, born in 1722, was one of the most flamboyant characters of the American Revolutionary era. He possessed boundless energy and enthusiasm, was cocksure of himself, and never met a colonist for whom he felt much respect. For him, the Americans were outlanders and bumpkin-like inferiors in comparison to the better sort of favored folks, especially the lord and ladies of their parent nation, Britain. Somehow, the upstart colonists were suffering from the same problem that Burgoyne failed to recognize in himself, a mounting sense of self-importance. They had lost sight of their proper place in the empire, having gone too far in resisting what Burgoyne believed to be, holding as he did a seat in Parliament in 1761, the reasonable taxation plans embodied in the Stamp Act passed in 1765, the Townsend Duties Acts passed in 1767, and finally the Tea Act passed in 1773 by the British Parliament. The obstreperous Americans needed a good dosage of military discipline, and Burgoyne was sure that he knew how to help administer the imperial spanking. Gentleman John Burgoyne was, in fact, an upstart himself. Born into a respectable, though not wealthy, family, he may well have been the illegitimate son of Robert Benson, 1st Baron Bingley, who served as young Burgoyne's godfather. When Bingley died in 1731, he provided handsomely for his godson's future. By the 1750s, Burgoyne had established his basic life patterns. He bought an officer's commission, but had to sell it to pay off his gambling debts. He carefully maintained his ties with influential members of the England aristocracy. In 1751, he eloped with Lady Charlotte Stanley, the youngest daughter of Sir Edward Stanley, 11th Earl of Derby, who had extensive political connections and sat in the House of Lords. Derby was not happy about the elopement, having wanted his daughter to marry someone of more respectable social status. Eventually, he and John Burgoyne reconciled, which opened many more doors among the ranks of powerful persons in clash-conscious England for Burgoyne. Keeping up his military career, Burgoyne won accolades for leading a successful cavalry charge in Portugal during the Seven Years' War. Supposedly, his fair-minded treatment of soldiers in an era when brutal discipline was meted out to the rank and file won him the affectionate title of gentleman. Perhaps it was his dapper personality or ability to lose with grace, as he so often did with his gambling addiction. Whatever the reason, his peers liked him, as did King George, whose interests he actively supported in Parliament. In 1772, John Burgoyne, who had kept his military career going, received a promotion to Major General. Then, in early 1775, the King persuaded him to join two other Major Generals in sailing it to America to put an end to the incipient rebellion brewing in Massachusetts. Along with Generals William Howe and Henry Clinton, he departed England without much fanfare. As one doggerel in a London newspaper sneered, "Behold the Cerberus, the Atlantic plow, her precious cargo, Burgoyne, Clinton, Howe, bow, wow, wow." Arriving in Boston in late May 1775, General Burgoyne contributed little and complained a lot. Supposedly, he quipped, in his usual disdainful manner, that he would make plenty of elbow room for British soldiers then entrapped in the city after the Lexington and Concord engagements. The local populace in turn dubbed Burgoyne General Elbow Room, an image that would have ironic meaning for him in another 2 years. Frustrated as the infrequently consulted junior major general of the Bow Wow Wow team, General Burgoyne received permission to sail back to London. He returned to gambling while also caring for his wife, Lady Charlotte, who was in bad health. He also used his personal charm and political connections to talk his way into a better wartime assignment. In early 1776, Burgoyne joined a flotilla of vessels carrying troops from England to the Quebec province in Canada. There, Burgoyne was to serve as second command under General Governor Guy Carleton, also a major general, whose military experience included beating French forces on the Plains of Abraham in 1759, securing Quebec City for the British Empire. Suffering a head wound in that engagement, Carleton went on to play a pivotal role in managing the transition of Canada from French to British sovereignty, as agreed to in the 1763 Treaty of Paris that ended the Seven Years' War in Europe and America. At first, General Burgoyne relished his new assignment, which was to assist General Governor Carleton in driving an American rebel invading force out of Canada. Seeking to have Quebec province become the 14th colony in rebellion, two American Patriot forces had invaded Quebec during the fall of 1775. One detachment, under the command of the wealthy New Yorker Major General Philip Schuyler, with a recently retired British officer, Richard Montgomery, serving as second command, moved up north to Lake Champlain from Fort Ticonderoga and in mid-November captured Montreal. The second column, led by Colonel Benedict Arnold, marched through the Maine wilderness and along the Chaudière River towards Quebec City. Schuyler, suffering from debilitating health issues, returned to New York. Montgomery and Arnold linked their forces together in early December, only to suffer an overwhelming defeat in a desperate attempt to capture the walled city of Quebec early in the morning of December 31st, 1775. General Montgomery was killed, and Colonel Arnold was seriously wounded. The Canadian campaign by the Americans never recovered from this defeat. Even though the Continental Congress gamely ordered hundreds more Patriot troops into Quebec province during the spring of 1776, they could not match the 12,000 British and Hessian soldiers who poured into Canada that spring, with General Burgoyne himself reaching Quebec City in early May 1776. A devastating outbreak of smallpox helped finish off the rebel campaign, with all the surviving American troops retreating all the way back to Fort Ticonderoga on Lake Champlain by mid to late June. Carleton and Burgoyne of the British worked harmoniously together during that spring and summer. They were now participants in an overall British strategic plan to cut off New England, the original center of the rebellion, from those colonies west and south of the Hudson River Lake Champlain water corridor. Home government leaders were working to concentrate a large force of 35,000 troops in the New York City area under British General William Howe, now commander-in-chief of all British forces in North America. Adding more than 12,000 troops in Canada represented a massive overall commitment to crushing the American rebellion, hopefully by the end of 1776. To implement the strategy, British General Howe was to move a sizable force up the Hudson River towards Albany, and Governor General Carleton was to float a naval land force southward across Lake Champlain to capture Fort Ticonderoga and then move on to Albany. As for General Burgoyne, he was to command the ground troops, reporting only to Carleton. Once united, the two armies would then march eastward towards Boston, wiping out any lingering rebel holdouts along the way. Royal Navy forces would bottle up any resistors in the various port towns along the Atlantic seaboard, in effect squeezing the American rebels into begging for the Crown's forgiveness. This Hudson River Lake Champlain strategy, given the sizable landmass of the 13 colonies, was straightforward, easy to understand, and possibly doable despite significant geographic obstacles in the region. The problem, however, was not so much reckoning with the logistical challenges of moving large forces across waterways and over swampy, hilly terrain, but with the generals themselves. More or less on his own, General Howe decided he would end the war more quickly and with greater personal glory by chasing after George Washington's Continentals and grinding them into the ground as they fled for their lives across New Jersey and over the Delaware River to Pennsylvania. General Clinton objected, so General Howe sent him off to establish a winter naval base in Rhode Island for the British. Governor General Carleton, for his part, was the most cautious of them all, not wanting to proceed south until he had a powerful enough naval fleet to clear Lake Champlain of any potential resistance. By the time he finally moved his flotilla onto the lake in early October, the number of days for sustained campaigning were almost gone, with colder autumn weather coming into play and frigid winter conditions lurking in the background. In sum, the British generals, pulling this way and that, had nothing to show for their campaign activities in 1776, despite so much effort on the part of the Crown to get them thousands of troops and enough military supplies to crush the ever-growing rebellion before it was too late. As for General Burgoyne, who is now having doubts about General Carleton's cautionary leadership and also thinking about greater martial glory for himself, placed in charge of land forces that followed along after Carleton's fleet, he could not believe that the governor stopped his southward movement at Crown Point on Lake Champlain, some 12 miles north of Fort Ticonderoga. General Carleton, after considering such basics as maintaining a secure supply line back to Canada over the winter, as well as having been impressed by the fighting prowess of the American Patriot Fleet defending Lake Champlain, decided to pull back all his land and naval forces to regroup for a timelier invasion in 1777. Campaign number 4, Gentleman John Burgoyne's Great Gamble, Ticonderoga to Saratoga, will be continued. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.